G'day, welcome back to the Humans of Agriculture podcast. As I always say, I'm so grateful to each of you that are tuning in. Now, if you don't follow the Humans of Ag podcast, can you hit follow on your favourite podcast app? And if you want to give us a review, we'd love to know, what do you love about it? And what would you like us to start to cover? What are some of those stories that you'd love to see us going and finding? We're getting towards the tail end of our series with the Syngenta Growth Awards winners. And this week, we're heading across the ditch to New Zealand to chat with their special trade envoy and farmer, Hamish Ma. Hamish farms alongside his parents and brother, and he has just such an interesting and refreshing outlook on the landscape of New Zealand agriculture. Now, I know that lots and lots of you listen to our episodes all the way to the end, but this week, there is a special little feature at the end. When I asked Hamish what his proudest moment was in his ag career, he shares the story of a young fella called Fergus who approached him several years ago and asked Hamish if he could teach him how to farm. Now, it's not every day that questions like that come, and I think amongst all the different things that Hamish has done, the fact that this is his proudest and most special achievement really speaks volumes for what it is. Now, Fergus's story doesn't finish there, so you better listen in, and we'd love to know what you reckon. Well, welcome back to the Humans of Agriculture podcast. We're continuing our conversations with different Syngenta Growth Award winners, and this one's coming to us from across the ditch, Hamish Ma. Mate, how's it all going over there?
Well, we're in the middle of summer here. It's been hot for us where I live, you know, day after day of over 30 degrees, which the last two summers haven't been that way, but this year El Nino has certainly kicked in January, and it's good.
You quite like the heat, do you?
Well, I'm an arable farmer predominantly, so I need summer and summertime to help me get our crops harvested and things. Yeah.
I'm really interested. When I was reading your bio, literally within the first probably 10 words, it had the Hamish is an arable farmer involved in his family business. Can you just explain to me, like, what is arable farming? And I know that sounds like a really silly question, but I'd say not many people kind of describe themselves as an arable farmer.
That is a great question because, I mean, we use that term quite generically. I mean, if you look it up in the dictionary, arable simply means land that can be ploughed. So, you know, we use that term meaning the farmers that grow crops, but the true definition of it is we're farming land that's able to be cultivated. And so, you know, there's many different facets and definitions of arable farming, but for me, in our operation here, production of grains, wheat, oats, barley, small seeds, so grass seed, clovers, we grow processed peas for freezing, and we run cattle and sheep, but we're predominantly arable farming.
And are you on the farm where you grew up as well?
Yep. So I'm here with my brother and his wife and family, and I'm here with my wife and family and my mum and dad. We're still here. We're fifth generation farming this particular piece of dirt. My ancestors came here from Scotland in 1873, was subdivided off what was, you know, quite a big station in New Zealand terms, and yeah, we've been here ever since.
Can you explain to me a little bit about, I guess, your connection to the land, but maybe the region in which you farm with? And I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but when I was in New Zealand a couple of years ago, I loved how people talked about their connection to the land, but it was in a few different ways. So I'd be interested to understand from you.
Yeah, that's another good question. There's probably no right or wrong answer. New Zealand, unlike Australia, you know, you can drive 20 minutes and the landscape is completely different. So we live an hour south of Christchurch, inland under the Southern Alps. So we're on the right at the top edge of the Canterbury Plains. We're 1,200 mil rainfall, 450 metres above sea level. And we live in a nice part of the world, but it's a very challenging part of the world. Our weather comes at us from all directions. So we get snow from the south and we get gale winds from the west. The hot, dry wind that comes past Australia then comes on and blows through our place. That makes farming here quite challenging, coupled with altitude and rainfall. But my connection to the land really comes back to the, you know, thinking about the history of the people that have gone before us and the legacy that they have left in terms of the trees and the fencing and the, you know, the infrastructure that have been put in place. And we carry on the respect that they had for the land and farming it in a way that, you know, if you think about when the people first came here, and there was no infrastructure, there was no improvements, and they learnt how to get on with nature or get on with the environment and farm in a sustainable manner. You know, we've got so much more technology now that, you know, helps us do all these things. But actually, you have to farm in a way that fits in with the particular climate and the particular area that you're in. You know, my connection with the land is the combination of A, respecting the people that have gone before us, but B, totally respecting the constraints that we have here in a way that hopefully means some of my children and my brother's children will be able to, you know, carry on doing what we're doing.
I love that you mention your children and your brother's children. The thing which I actually implemented kind of in our business after spending some time in New Zealand last year was that talk, or I guess, yeah, the recognition of legacy and that reference to kind of children's children. And I think, as you said, you're kind of a fifth generation farmer. Like the ancestors who have gone before you have left it in a place that it's sustainable into the future. And I think in farming, when we look at kind of that generational sustainability of not just a productive business that allows people to have a livelihood in terms of the care for the natural environment as well, that your children, but also your children's children, really is a mark of true sustainability.
Yeah, well, you know, it's your home, isn't it? And, you know, I always tell people that, you know, we've got a garden around our house, but we've got a 500 hectare garden, you know, beyond that too. And so, you know, it's just an extension. Our farm is an extension of where we live. I like to, you know, treat it all the same way. So that, you know, I think when you're in your 20s, I often think about this, when you're in your 20s and you've got your work futures in front of you and everything, nothing's a problem and everything's great, then, you know, the whole world's in front of you and you think about all these things. And then, you know, the older you get, all of a sudden you start thinking about your children and what they're going to end up doing. And what I said before about thinking about the people that have gone before us and how important, you know, that we take forward the lessons that they learned.
Totally. Now, what was your influence? Why did you decide to pursue agriculture and go down that pathway? Obviously, you studied at Lincoln University, which so many agriculturalists in New Zealand do, but what was it that drew you in?
Well, I think I'm one of those people, like a lot of farmers, that, you know, we followed our father around, and that's just what you were going to do one day. I went away and was an agronomist for a wee while, and as you say, I went to Lincoln, and I've done a few things, but in the back of all of that was always that one day I was going to be farming. Now, our parents never pushed us into agriculture, and in fact, they said to us a couple of times, are you sure this is what you want to do? You know, there's a lot of things you can go and do in your life. You don't have to come home to the farm here. But, you know, it was just in me for whatever reason. I just wanted to carry on, you know, doing what was done. And we, you know, I spent not so much my brother because he's a little bit younger, but I spent a lot of time with my grandfather. And, you know, it's just what I wanted to do.
That's pretty special. Tell me about getting involved outside the farm gate. You're involved with the Federated Farmers. You are the special envoy for New Zealand, which we can kind of talk to. But that involvement outside the farm gate, how did you actually get started and why?
Well, I've always been a guy that likes the interaction with people. And I guess if you ask any of my friends, they'll probably tell you the same thing. And amongst it all, Hamish will be there somewhere. you know, I just enjoy the interaction with people, and I enjoy the nutting out of things and working for common purpose and all that kind of thing. And I was very lucky when I left university, I got a job as an agronomist, and I had a huge client list which sent me around to many different types of farming around New Zealand here. And it opened my eyes to, you know, a lot of different ways that things can be done, a lot of different techniques of things. But also it got me in front of a lot of different people, so that when I eventually came home here a few years later, I had quite a network of people or business associates that I'd met in an agronomy role. And I just found my way into small committees for a start. You know, we all end up on a committee somewhere. And then one by one, I found my way onto bigger things that led me on to a Nuffield Scholarship, which I did in 2019. Our parents had always been involved in things. My father had been on the school board from the year I started school till the year my sister left. So, you know, their mum and dad were always very community minded, still are very community minded. So they certainly encouraged us to, you know, to go off and do other things. My brother, for example, he coaches rugby and he's the chairman of our local bike club. So we're all doing our wee bit. But, you know, I enjoy the off-farm stuff because it stimulates my brain in, you know, in different ways.
And I think it probably makes total sense and maybe unsurprising in any of the categories that you could have been a growth award winner that you were in the community and people section as a grower, given your contributions to your community, but also agriculture in New Zealand more broadly?
Yeah, well, it's quite funny there, because when I was nominated for that, the Syngenta person that nominated me, we were sitting around our kitchen table working out which category I should go in, and we ummed and ahed, and in the end we went for sustainability because of some other things that I'd done in terms of agronomy and my Nuffield scholarship and things. And then when it came time to the award night in Sydney, they said, oh, we have changed a few people's category around. And I didn't think it would be me. But anyway, we went through the sustainability section and Hamish didn't get anywhere. And I thought, oh, well, no, that's fine, because the other people in the room are far more deserving than I was. And then in the community and people one, I got the award and I couldn't believe it. Having heard all the other people that were nominated and their stories, you know, to think that I'd got that award, I was, you know, blown away. And remember when I went up onto the stage, you know, I had a few things lined up in my head that I would say in terms of the sustainability story and things. But I actually was lost for words in terms of, you know, what I should say as a sort of valedictory, if that's the right word. Or, you know, thank you. So I was very, very humbled, but very, very surprised at the same time.
And it was so interesting being there on the night, because I know each of you had your different categories and you're obviously, you're in there and so you're a shot in the different categories. But so many people were kind of speechless. And I think, well, yeah, I'd be interested in you. What did you take away? You got to spend the day with a whole bunch of different people from all different backgrounds in the day, definitely, of the awards. What did you kind of take away? And maybe what was, for the people who weren't, I guess, fortunate enough, which is all of our listeners pretty well, what did you kind of take away? What did agriculture look like in that room and who were the kind of humans that you were spending the day with?
Well, I think the word you'd use there, if you were to sum all that up in one word, it's just diversity. And if you can split that word diversity up into two sections, and it's the diversity of people. And, you know, all of these different people so skilled at what they do, working in different things within their own operations and their own communities and their own ways of doing things. And then, but then also the diversity of food that is being produced in New Zealand and Australia. I was blown away what some people were doing in terms of, you know, what they were producing on their farms and how they were doing it and the challenges they were overcoming and things. And I, you know, one thing I did think about a lot and reflected on since, and you know, that we're actually all trying to do the same things, but we're all in different areas. So we all have to do things in a different way and we all have to produce things that suit the particular place that we've got. And I sort of come back to what I said earlier on about our forefathers all worked out what suited and what didn't. And then we just carry on respecting that knowledge that they have and drive forward. But yeah, diversity was the thing I took away from all that.
Yeah, totally agree. And you'd get to do, well, obviously a Nuffield scholarship, which we can talk about, but you've done quite a bit of different travel. But this trip specifically, what is it that you're looking forward to about, I guess, yeah, alongside the different food producers and also the cotton producers that kind of won? What is it that you're looking forward to most about that trip to those couple of different areas of Europe?
For me, it's the opportunity to have your eyes opened to things that, you know, we're not exposed to in the Southern Hemisphere. And, you know, both Australia and New Zealand, farming essentially came from Europe. You know, our forefathers generally came from Europe, came down here, bought the ideas, and we've carried it on. And so a lot of the big tech companies are based up there. A lot of the innovation is happening up there. Huge population and huge market. You know, Europe's a population of 450 million people. So they're a very, very important market for both of our countries. And so to have the opportunity to go to where it all began and go to where a lot of our markets are and see how those two things are aligning, those are the opportunity to look at all the technology. And, you know, to go to Syngenta's facilities up there will be really eye-opening, I'm sure, because, you know, we rely on science these days. We rely on technology to overcome the majority of the problems we have on farm. And without the help of companies like Syngenta, the problems that they solve will just come straight back. So, you know, we need them, but we also need to understand what they're doing and hopefully get the opportunity to provide a bit of feedback about what we need too.
Absolutely. What an awesome and incredible opportunity to do that.
Oh, wonderful. I'm interested. Yeah.
What we're talking about, I guess, that science, your Nuffield topic, which you mentioned you studied in 2019, was looking at the use of glyphosate. Can you tell me more, I guess, why that topic, when you set it out, what were you trying to, I guess, find out and discover? And then maybe we can chat about where it ended up taking you.
Yeah, no trouble. I'll try and give you a very, very quick synopsis. So essentially, and for me, in arable farming, but actually farming in general in developed countries, we don't think about it, but Roundup really dictates the way we do things on the ground. It dictates the way we prepare soil. It dictates the way we plant crops, all of those things. And there was some talk there's been talk for many years that Roundup was going to be banned in Europe, and there was real push in New Zealand here for it to be deregistered also. And so for the reasons I just said about it underpinning our farming system, I wanted to understand. I set off actually, first of all, wanting to know, could we farm without it? And if you look at my report online, I actually have called it, Can We Farm Without Glyphosate? But it sort of morphed into more of an investigation of what the issues are with Roundup usage and actually the whole Roundup story. And so that topic led me all around the world, looking at farming systems, talking to people, led me to supermarkets, talked to doctors, talked to people, anyone that would listen to me on a plane, in an airport, on a bus. I started talking to them about what they thought about agriculture, about food production, and then, you know, where does Roundup fit in amongst all that? It's a very, very complicated story. Essentially, there's two things. The pushback against Roundup is really a pushback to me. It's always been about following on from this trip. It's a pushback against genetic modification, and, you know, GE cropping has really seen the use of Roundup skyrocket through the introduction of Roundup Ready cropping. And in a nutshell, Roundup Ready cropping has been really good in terms of taking bad things out of our food chain. But what it has done is, instead of small amounts of Roundup being used in those countries, now we've got large amounts of Roundup being used instead of atrazine, instead of 2,4-D, instead of some other things. And so all of a sudden now we've got Roundup in our food chain. So though the pushback that we hear from the consumer, but from anyone who's pushing back, it's really not against the product per se. It's really against the way we're using it, and a pushback against GE. What Roundup did for agriculture, and this is the piece that people don't understand when they talk about we need to ban it. What Roundup did to agriculture instantly was buy farmers time. So prior to Roundup being introduced, the only way to establish a crop and a clean seed bed was to cultivate it until the weeds all died. Now, in some places, probably not in Australia where it's dry, but certainly here in New Zealand, that time period could be up to 6 months. The introduction of Roundup meant we could spray this herbicide on this afternoon and we could drill tomorrow morning without any fear of damaging the resulting crop through residual. So instantly, that chemical has bought us 6 months of production. Now, I'm not saying it's 6 months everywhere. It'll be a lot less in other parts of the world, but it's that time factor that would really impact agriculture and global food production if we were to lose it. So that's the Roundup story in a nutshell. My recommendation, my recommendation at the end of all that is that we really need, you know, we depend on Roundup for food production. If we want to be responsible, we need to think about the way we're using it and, you know, use it where necessary. Adopt some IPM techniques, and by that I mean that means go have a look, make a decision. Do we actually need to do it or do we not? Rather than just, this is what we've always done, so this is what we'll keep on doing. Actually adopt some management for the good of food production and for the prosperity of the product.
Hi, I'm Pia, horticulture and sugar analyst at Rabobank, and I'm here to share our latest insights on Australia's vegetable market. Did you know in 2023, Australia produced over $5.8 billion worth of vegetables, though only 4.3% of this was exported? Like many other countries, the Australian vegetable industry relies mostly on its domestic market. In fact, only 7% of global vegetables produced are traded between countries. But we are starting to see that trend change. Global trade is growing at a faster rate than production, and countries with low-cost production are seeing the highest growth rates. You can learn more about trends in the vegetable market on our latest Rabo Research Australia podcast, Mapping World Vegetable Trade, or reach out to me via the Rabobank Australia social media channels to learn more.
How challenging was it for you to kind of keep your assumptions to the side and remain really open-minded and curious?
It was relatively straightforward because I was genuinely interested when I got to the United States. You know, when I was at Lincoln, we were told that genetic modification was going to be the ruination of humanity, that lettuces were going to grow legs and run out of the glass house and out of the garden, and tomatoes were going to grow heads and start talking to us. And so when I got to the United States and got in front of some scientists and, you know, actually had the story explained to me, you know, all of a sudden the world opens up in front of your eyes, and then you take a global view, I guess, not the right way to say it, but a really open view about the system that I was working in. You know, I was thinking about my farm here in New Zealand and my small patch of the world. But then when you start thinking globally and at scale, all of a sudden I was able to step back. And I like to think I had a really independent chain of thought because I was genuinely interested in what I was hearing.
And I think it's so fascinating. And I was reading an article that I think it was when you were announced as the special envoy for New Zealand. And it was around this, and it's this evolution of agriculture and obviously the growth and interest in plant-based meat, yeah, plant-based proteins and what that actually means. But it's so interesting, isn't it? And I think at the beginning you talked about it where it was your home's a 500, it's the garden around the house, but it's also the 500 hectares around it. And in agriculture, there's so much emotion tied to what is happening that sometimes people view it as a personal attack. And I guess I'd be really interested in when it came to actually presenting this to rooms of farmers and go, maybe the way we're using Roundup right now isn't the most responsible or the way it's going to be forever. How was it received?
I've spoken with garden clubs and Lions clubs and farmer groups and everything, and I haven't had one bit of criticism. I did get stalked on Twitter once telling me that what I was saying is all lies, but, you know, I know myself that it's not. Generally, what I was talking about was very, very well received. And, you know, Roundup has got the biggest label of any agricultural chemical on the planet. By that, I mean it's got the widest spectrum of use in terms of its application. You can apply it to just about any plant species, depending on the rate, but also a whole lot of different applications in terms of conservation tillage and pre-planting and post-planting and desiccation. Now, some of that science was written in the 70s and it hasn't changed, but, you know, we've learned a lot in agriculture and in science and in health and a whole lot of different areas that the label hasn't really been updated. But when you think about it logically, you know, some of it may, you know, we just have to go forward sensibly. And so when I was talking about that, you know, think again, and we were talking off air about thinking with your marketing lens on, do you actually have to spray that on something that a human's going to eat? You know, those are the kind of thoughts that you have to think. And, you know, I haven't seen one bit of criticism about that.
No, and I think it's a really pragmatic way of looking at it, because I think ultimately it's, and I guess I've done enough spot spraying and putting chemical on and things like that. And I think coming back to going, well, at the end of the day, I'm a consumer and the products that I'm putting in my body, I actually want to make sure that it is healthy and safe and nutritious. I think we've got the systems or the structures around it to enable that. But also what I don't think we have is the platforms or the places for the conversations where people can kind of be curious and go, oh, well, actually this is, yeah, in the back of my mind, I am wondering how it is going to impact my health, whether that's accurate or not. But I think, yeah, the chance to actually discuss is probably not there.
Yeah, you know, and I think that, you know, consumers can have faith that the systems are in place generally that our food is very, very safe. I don't know what your laws are like in Australia, laws around MRLs and residues and things. You know, they're routinely testing food, and if you act responsibly, it's all right.
I'm keen. There's a couple of other areas I want to discuss with you. We're going to come, I think we finished with young Fergus at the end, but let's talk about your role as a special envoy and how, I guess, that has come about, why it's important for New Zealand agriculture, I guess actually just the New Zealand economy, and also what it's like for you to be sitting in that role.
Well, for your listeners, in July last year, I was appointed the New Zealand Special Agricultural Trade Envoy, which in a nutshell means that I am New Zealand's independent representative or farming representative to our government, to overseas governments, and to anyone in the supply chain buying our product offshore. And why that's important is that for New Zealand, 87 or 86% of our export revenue is dependent on agriculture. And so having someone on the ground with dirt under their fingernails that can actually explain, you know, what's going on the ground is very, very important. It's a very, very humbling role for me to have been given, and it's a role I don't take lightly. You know, there's a lot of wonderful people that have done this role before me, so it's pretty special. And I, you know, we come back to the work I'd done off farm earlier on. That was the stepping stone to all that, the combination of a Nuffield and working with Federated Farmers and some other industry organisations meant that I've got the understanding of what goes on the ground, but also I've got the understanding of what happens in the background and the network of people on the ground that makes that happen. Well, I was just up in Europe a wee while ago, and it's before Christmas actually. I flew into Sydney from Europe, so I was very jet-lagged when we were at the Syngenta Growth Awards. But, you know, just about every meeting I went to with government or with farming groups or whatever, we're all very interested in knowing, you know, what we're doing on the ground in farming about, you know, about ABC, about climate change, about sustainability, about, you know, what are you doing to, you know, lower your diesel use? What are you doing for labour, you know, farm succession, all of those things, which, again, we think we've got an isolation on our own place or our own country, but actually every country is grappling with the same issues. And so the independent voice of the farmer is very important in those conversations. And to sit alongside the, you know, our government people that are doing the regulatory piece on one side, and then to have the producer there in the meetings actually explaining how we're implementing the regulation, it's very, very powerful.
I can imagine. And as you mentioned, New Zealand agriculture and food is the number one export for you guys. Your whole economy is underpinned by it. Over recent years, there's kind of been some different discussions around, I guess, agriculture. From the outside looking in, it feels like the sentiment of, I guess, the Kiwi pride of that, yeah, I guess you guys have been built off and continue to, I guess, run off the back of agriculture. How is that sentiment? Is it changing? And how are you guys kind of, I guess, managing that?
Well, yeah, we are totally reliant on agriculture. The sentiment, it's a very interesting question when you talk about sentiment. And I mean, do you mean, is there an urban-rural divide? Is that what you mean by sentiment? Or do you mean sentiment within agriculture?
No, let's talk, yeah, the sentiment from outside of ag, of the views of New Zealand, I guess, the way that you guys are managing the environment and what you guys are doing.
Well, I would say that we're fortunate in New Zealand that we're a lovely temperate island climate, blessed with good soil, plenty of rain generally. So, you know, we farm to the environment. We're not like Europe or the United States where you're dealing with extreme heat or extreme cold. Generally, the sentiment from offshore looking at New Zealand is one that's very positive. You know, that being said, we always have to strive to, you know, we can't sit on our laurels, can we? We always have to strive to try and do better. So that's the challenge, because one day the rest of the world will catch up with us.
Totally. And it's interesting, isn't it? And Australia's similar, where the bulk of our customers are actually the people who we're not farming in and around. And that's an interesting one, isn't it? Where it's kind of, I guess, community sentiment versus consumer sentiment towards what's happening in agriculture.
Yeah. And I think that you look at the Northern Hemisphere now, particularly in Europe, anyone who's seen the news has seen huge protests in, you know, in Germany and France. I see this morning in Spain, Brussels, they've all had, you know, and extreme protests too, you know. I saw them dipping soil on the motorway and then drilling wheat in there.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty extreme. You know, I think that generally if you spoke to the consumer on the ground here, actually people are pretty happy with what we're doing, and that the sentiment generally for agriculture is pretty good. And I would think that you would find the same thing in Australia. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're not subsidised. We have no protection from government. We have to be efficient, otherwise we don't survive. And so with efficiency comes good management practice. I think, you know, what I see in some other places is that subsidy leads to just doing what we've always done, which means you get what you've always got. So, you know, in Australia and New Zealand, I think the lack of protection means that we're a lot more agile and we're a lot quicker to adapt to what, A, the constraints are in front of us, but B, probably what the people want. So that's probably my take on the sentiment part of it.
Yeah, I completely agree on that, because I think that then comes down to, like, you're market-driven, so you're going to be efficient, you're going to be more profitable if you're going with what actually the market is dictating as opposed to what's probably being pushed back on you to grow a practice. So, Hamish, I guess the only other thing I wanted to talk to you about, and I'm keen to hear it from the horse's mouth, is this story of young Fergus. And if you can paint the picture, I guess, from what I understand, you had a young fella come and say, "Hamish, can you teach me to be a father?"
That's almost it in a nutshell, except he wrote me a letter. This is an interesting thing about these awards too. So the first question when I was interviewed about the awards for the judging was, what's your most proudest achievement in agriculture? And, you know, I knew I was nominated for the sustainability piece, and I thought, well, we'll get to that shortly, I guess. So I said, well, actually, the proudest thing for me, you know, outside of my own family, is that a young guy, when he was 14 years old, wrote me a letter with no connection to, well, father had worked on farms and they'd been farming in Scotland, but a young guy with no future and being able to be a farmer wrote me a letter, posted it and said, I'm 14 years old, I'd like to be a farmer, can you teach me? And so I rang him up straight away and said, yes, you're hired. He'd written in this letter all the things that he couldn't do. You know, most people write down what they can do. He wrote down what he couldn't. You know, things like he couldn't drive a harvester, he couldn't plough a paddock, he couldn't spray, he couldn't, all of these things that a 14-year-old couldn't do anyway. But he'd listed all off all these stuff that he couldn't do. And so this young boy came to us every day after school. He came on the school bus. My own children were on there as well, and he would get on the bus wearing a school uniform, and he'd get off wearing his work boots and shorts. And every day he took all that stuff to school with him. And he came, and I said to him that I'll give you the best apprenticeship I can give you, but you have to start off, you know, learning to sweep a floor and learning to take rubbish away and, you know, learning all those things. And so he did all that. So where are we? 4 years later, he's our number one guy now. He works for us full time. There's probably only one thing on this farm he can't do, and I'll get him to that very shortly. But he's a success story, and, you know, I don't know where he'll end up in his life, but if everyone had the work ethic that he has got and the attitude that he has got, then there would be no problems in the world. So when they asked me what was my proudest achievement, I straight away talked about Fergus, because, you know, he's a success story. He couldn't be farming, but now he is, and he's involved in our industry, and our industry is very lucky to have him today, and I'm hoping in 20 years' time we'll still have him somewhere. I doubt that'll be with me, because one day he'll be too good for me, I would think.
That's so cool. You mentioned there's one thing he can't do. What is that?
Oh, it's just driving our sprayer. And it's just, but I'll get into that. It's just all around, you know, the complexities of spraying and, you know, where you're going and what you're doing and tank hygiene and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, he's not 18 yet, so I think that given a bit of time, we'll get him there.
And so he's with you guys full time now?
Yeah, he did all our drilling last year. I sowed two fields, and I think he did everything else.
That's incredible.
So, yeah, he's just a machine. And he's from a nice family. The thing that sets him apart is his attitude and his willingness, and he's just keen to be involved.
So, Hamish, I've got one question that I ask everyone that comes on the podcast. So I guess my background, to preface it, I grew up in Sydney and then came into agriculture. But when I was in year 10, there was a conversation, I guess, that I had with a mate, and he kind of said, what's the future in farming? Why would you kind of do it? And I think for me, there was a real misunderstanding between friends in Sydney, between careers advisors. They just didn't understand the potential. So when I get the chance, I love asking people that if you had the chance to kind of talk to 16-year-old Ollie or 16-year-olds today about what agriculture actually looks like today and what the opportunities are, what would you say to them?
Oh, it's a very complicated question, that, because to me, you've got to separate the business of farming away from the actual practicalities of farming. And you ask any farmer about the enjoyment of sowing a crop and then watching that field for 3 or 4 or 5 days or 10 days or whatever, and then watching all that crop emerge, and then joy you get looking into the rows as they're coming up in the morning sun or the setting sun, and all those things, the pride you have in, you know, producing a nice line of sheep or some, you know, big fat cattle or, you know, or whatever it is that you're growing, a tree full of apples or, you know, whatever the situation in agriculture. And I'm sure it's the same in any small business, to be honest, not just agriculture, but the enjoyment you get from seeing the fruits of your labours through to the end and through to a product that someone's going to buy, and the fact that you can put your name on that and say, well, actually, in every tonne of wheat that leaves my place, there's a little bit of me inside it. For me, that's the, or every, you know, every kg of sheep or whatever, there's a little bit of the Ma family involved in that. So there's the pride factor involved. The business factor is a little bit different in the fact that I think that when you talk to people of my father's generation or a bit younger maybe even, there was a genuine pathway into farming now through land ownership that I'm not quite sure is there for many people just because of the price of farmland. And so that makes farming and the achievement of being a farmer that much more difficult because of the capital requirement to get into agriculture. And I would say that at the moment, you know, we're a family farm. Yes, we've got some debt because, you know, through 5 generations, there's got to be some farm succession go on. But, you know, we're only treading water. We had a great harvest last year, one of the best we've ever had, but we're really only standing still. And so there's a real shortage of capital in agriculture that makes that business part of farming actually quite difficult. But I guess what I'm coming to in all that, if you bring the enjoyment part of it on one side and the business part of it on the other, somewhere in the middle, there's the piece that I would call lifestyle. And so if you can accept that sometimes it's going to be a struggle, then farming's a wonderful way of life. And it's certainly, you know, I often tell people that farming's the most noble occupation in the world, second only to medicine, because, you know, we have the responsibility to, we never think about this very often, but, you know, we have the responsibility of feeding the people in a sustainable and healthy way. And so it's the longevity of the populace hangs on what we do every day. So it's a really, really exciting industry to be in. And I am, you know, you don't have to own a farm to be a farmer, and you don't have to be farming to be involved in agriculture. There's so many people involved in the supply chain and the value chain. We're desperate for good people. So my message to anyone 16 thinking about doing a qualification of any kind is do it in agriculture, because there'll always be a job.
Hamish, thank you so much. I love how you were able to bring those different pieces together and how you explained it. I can nearly see the sun hitting the roses as they're growing. So thank you so much for sitting down and having a chat.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
I really enjoyed it, and hopefully we get to cross paths in person one day and say good day.
I'd love to. Yeah, I've really enjoyed the opportunity to chat to you. And if anyone wants to reach out, you can find me easily. So it's been my pleasure.
We'll include a couple of links to you in the show notes and go from there.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for another episode from us here at Humans of Agriculture. We hope you're enjoying these podcasts. And, well, if you're not, let us know. Hit us up at hello@humansofagriculture.com. Get in touch with any guest recommendations, topics, or things you'd like us to talk and get curious about. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Rate, subscribe, review it. Any feedback is absolutely awesome, and we really do welcome it. So look after yourselves, stay safe, stay sane. We'll see you next time. See ya.